Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
Coming to you live from the great metropolis of Monsteropolis in the state of Ohio, buried deep in the jungles near River Styx. The River Styx. This is a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. And I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined today by
Mark Matzke.
And also joining us is
Andy Matzke.
You're going to need to lean into that.
Lean in.
You haven't done podcasting in a while, have you?
No,
you're
out of the loop. In a long time.
All right. Andy, real quick, introduce yourself and who you are.
My name is Andy Matzke. I hosted two podcasts in the past, Monsterland Ohio Radio and Sasquatch, a show about Bigfoot.
Co-hosted.
Co-hosted.
You weren't the only host on that. Your dad was there.
Okay, I co-hosted
those shows. So we do have a Gmail address, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. We have not yet received any email. Well,
we might have.
I'm locked out right now. But if you're listening to the show and you want to send us emails, please feel free to do that.
And if you have sent one
and, if you
and
have,
you're waiting,
we'll get to it.
Probably why.
Yeah. So this week's show, this week we're talking about... Again, like for listeners, we record multiple episodes at a time, so we have not yet picked what the next slew of episodes are, but we are, in the coming weeks, going to be discussing Thunderbirds, the Jersey Devil, and the Dover Demon, possibly in a completely different order from how I just said that. But this week, we're talking about
Phenomenos.
So yeah, I don't even know where to start. And as I told you guys when you got here, my wife was sick this morning. This was supposed to be my big day. I put it off all week. Like, this was going to be my big day to get the whole show in order. And then she got sick and I had Tommy here and it just all went out the window. So instead we're just winging it. But let's talk about...
Before we get started,
okay,
yeah. I think we should be specific with this particular episode and talk Beast of Bray Road and sort of limit it in that way. Because when I was preparing for today, what I realized is that Michigan Dogman is such
a big
there's
story.
So much.
Okay, because I had gone, one of the only pieces of research for this I did was I watched some sort of short YouTube documentary about the Beast of Land Between the Lakes.
Oh,
so
yeah,
this,
well, we can
which
whet
is good,
the appetite.
Well, no,
right?
Because like I found it fascinating, but I also saw a lot of conflicting information, and I was actually hoping I would get into more of my research on that this morning. So maybe. Maybe we do the Beast of Bray Road today, and then we can dive into maybe a two-parter and try to talk about the Beast of Land Between the Lakes in the coming weeks. So yes, today we're talking about the Beast of Bray Road. Again, this is the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. We just put out a film titled The Bray Road Beast, so we're talking about this because we have some semblance of knowledge about this particular topic. In fact, all three of us were at Bray Road itself. And so we've all been involved in interviewing witnesses and people that have actively looked into this subject. So where do we want to start though? Do we want to start? So So the most common thread for, and I've done like probably 30 interviews about this subject now, the most common thread that people follow is they want to start out and be like, when did all this start? And you start with that, like the classic late 89, 91, 92, the Inside Edition story runs in like 93 or 94, right? And that's when it like balloons into the public eye. That's one thing that I think is interesting about the Beast of Bray Road. But before we get any further, because I can already tell I'm going to just start talking way off track. Why don't you describe what the Beast of Bray Road is in terms of physical description?
Okay. The Beast of Bray Road, generally speaking, is an what's described as an upright walking canid creature that can go back and forth between all fours and hind legs. Witnesses often describe that the creature has backwards facing knees, but that can be explained as just a dog's natural back hind foot. Ooh, and that's I just saw a graphic depiction of one. And then it's almost always described as a very muscular, you know, having a type of almost human musculature to it, like six-pack abs, huge shoulders. And the reason I say that is it comes up in a witness report that I'm going to talk about today that predates the typical ones. That it's the one that just appeared
the
on
80s.
The 87.
Yeah.
Really one cool that one. Just showed up on Linda Godfrey's blog.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just it's there's some variance, but for the most part, you hear the description as a dog-like or a wolf-like head with the distinctive ears and a muzzle and large teeth. Often the eyes are glowing and glowing red. And there's even a way that the creature tends to look at people, or a feeling that they get in which they feel threatened, or as if the creature is asserting some sort of dominant behavior.
Oh, German Shepherd is the most people talk about. I read a negative review for our movie where someone was like, this movie was an hour and a half of people saying it looked like a German Shepherd over and over again. But yeah, the German Shepherd description comes up a lot. So the sightings start in when this whole thing kind of bursts into the public eye isn't until like 90. When did her first article, Linda Godfrey's first article, run?
It was, let's see, more than 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it was, I think, 89.
Mm-hmm.
Like the change of the year. So it's like the end of the year issue of the week.
Okay. So, it kicked off with, it came into her view when Doris Gibson had her sighting out on Bray Road, by the way, right in the same location. I don't know if I've told you that. Did you look at where Doris's sighting actually happened?
No.
On a map? It's where we saw the thing go across the road.
No kidding.
Yeah, the exact. In fact, if you
right there by Hospital
if you
Road,
watch
is
that yeah, if you yeah. watch that Inside Edition interview with her, she's standing. You can basically see right where we were standing behind her,
mm-hmm.
which I think is kind of cool. We had our own brush with a deer.
Yes.
that was falsely misidentified as a dog man when we were in Elkhorn late one night, and it just so happened that it took place in the exact spot of Doris Gibson's sighting, which took place in 1989, and Doris is 91, and it's actually
Andreese
yeah. that had her sighting in 89. So that's the weird thing about the Beast of Bray Road story is that the sightings. Do you find this too, that the sightings are taking place? There's the chronology of what actually happened is a little hard to follow.
Yeah.
Like when I was actually putting the whole thing together, it was difficult for me to figure out whose sightings were happening when.
There's so many sightings that are reported like years after when it takes place, and they're always said like, oh, it was after the Andreese sighting or something. It's always like most of the sightings afterwards are said to be in relation to another sighting, and it just gets all misconstrued.
Yeah. Especially because the first sighting isn't the first sighting that really was talked about. Andreese was the first sighting, but it didn't, I mean, the first sighting on Bray Road, other than this 87 report. I also have seen something that talked about Bigfoot reports or something similar in the area during the 70s. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
Around Elkhorn.
Really?
There was a rash of sightings of something else in the area. I need to talk to Linda about this too, because I think if we ever revisited the subject in a film, that would be an interesting side story to talk about. But regardless, there's a really weird history in that area of upright walking canids. And our favorite, like the story that brought me into the whole thing, was the Ghidara sighting that happened at St. Coletta's, which is in Jefferson County, which is an adjoining county. And that sighting happened in 1936. A night watchman at St. Coletta's was wandering the grounds and basically had two encounters with the creature over two subsequent nights. The weirdest thing about it was that the creature he saw was walking upright, obviously some sort of upright walking dog, but it said the word Ghidara to him. And Ghidara is the town where the demon possessed man was in. The demons were cast out of a man by Jesus. They went into swine. Swine jumped off a cliff, and the story they all lived happily ever after.
that's one version.
St. Coletta's, though, can we kind of reminisce about St. Coletta's? Because like that was actually one of my favorite moments of the whole trip. I'm looking at you like you're supposed to chime in there with your own thoughts on St. Coletta's.
Yeah. Well, St. Coletta's was so interesting because I don't know what mental picture I had in my mind before we were there, but when we got there, it was so different because the whole campus is quite large. It takes up, you know, this big section of where it is. And then when you get up on the hill where it's sited, there's an old church there. And it was really cool because we were all just like, we're there, and it was interesting to like visualize the whole area, because what you think of when you think of Bray Road and all those sightings is very different from what it is. And like just being there, it was really creepy too. It's very normal, like it's mentioned in the movie, but it really is like normal Wisconsin. There's nothing different about it. It's just this normal part of the that has an extremely,
I would argue though, that St. Coletta's is very creepy.
It is very creepy. Like, it has this weird
St. Coletta's
vibe
itself. I would actually say St. Coletta's and then the Kettle Moraines where we went both had a weird vibe to them that I didn't get in Walworth County itself, which is kind of funny. But St. Coletta's especially, there was a sense of like history to that place, and I didn't get a good sense. Like it just mostly probably because it's like an abandoned mental facility of some sort that's as big as like a small college campus. Like it's a huge series of buildings, multiple buildings, all of them abandoned, windows broken out. Like it's kind of the classic haunted house, haunted insane asylum look to it. And I don't know if I told you about this, but like after the fact, I discovered that JFK's sister had been a patient there.
Right.
And so I think of all the places we filmed, that was the creepiest of on that entire trip.
Yeah, I kind of wandered up on the cemetery area, and that had to, you know, I've been in hundreds of cemeteries or hundreds of times been in cemeteries, but there was a kind of a weird feeling to it there, in part because there were a number of tombstones of younger people. And even children, I mean, looking at the dates, you could see that there were some fairly young people who didn't make it too long and were buried there, as well as nuns and priests and others. And you just had a sense of this history that had completely passed. And now, you know, the backdrop of that is the abandoned portion of the facility in the school. And it just gave you a very odd sense of historical area that's now, you know, probably completely forgotten for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, the church is still there and the church is still running, but the asylum or whatever you would call it has been closed down for years since, I think I read somewhere, since like the early 2000s, But one interesting thing about it, so when that Ghidorah sighting happened, the creature was standing on an old Indian burial mound. Those mounds are all gone, mm-hmm. but that apparently that those grounds were like sacred grounds. This is like the perfect setting for like Poltergeist 5 or something, you know, like it's the perfect setting for some sort of haunted activity to take place and like creepy stuff to happen.
Yeah.
But those, they apparently just, Linda told me this last time I saw her, they got rid of those mounds. Now, if they found like bodies inside, I don't know how that works, but, they basically bulldozed them all. So when you go there now, you can't actually find the mounds, but they did, at least when this happened, 36, they still surrounded the asylum.
Yeah.
Would you call it an asylum? I don't know what they called it.
Yeah, it's school? Fine. Yeah, school, asylum. I mean, it's,
there's not a difference.
No. You would know better than me.
Yeah. And you know, that's heightened, what you're saying, I think, it's heightened by the fact that Shackleman, the night watchman, observed the creature digging into one of those mounds. Like, on both times that he saw it. Mm-hmm. That's sort of how he came across it the first time, as it was on its knees and apparently digging into the mound looking for, you know, who knows what.
I was going to, there was another, the front of the building has these very elaborate sort of art deco sculptures or statues of like, well, St. Coletta, I would assume is on one of them, but like Mary's on one of them, Jesus and all that stuff. But there is something very unsettling. Just like that look is, it reminds me of the design of the early 2000s House on Haunted Hill film that had that whole like art deco style to the movie. And so there's, anyway, that whole side story to me has been underexplored. Like, I'd like to know more about St. Coletta's. In the movie, it's very briefly mentioned that Linda had discovered that a priest had performed an exorcism in the school just a few weeks prior to the night watchman encounter with the dogman. And I don't know if it's mentioned in the film, but she told us, or told me, I think she told us, I think it's in my notes, that the priest felt he had been followed home by whatever he had cast out of this student,
yeah,
quote unquote student at the school. So really creepy angles to that. And like, that's one thing about this story. It probably drives people like Lauren Coleman crazy, because like, you can't escape a supernatural connection with the Beast of Bray Road. And I don't know why that is, but like, I don't draw those. I don't typically try to find those connections. That's not, I just never do it. I it's like one of the last places I look with these stories. And with this one, you can't get away from it. It's just really strange. And we didn't even have the experience with John Fredrickson finding out about all this sort of satanic activity that was taking up. And I think for this episode, at least, like, steer clear of that stuff, because I do feel like we should probably focus more on the creature itself and the sightings and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if we get too far down into the occult stuff, it's just going to take this in a completely different direction than we need to go. But we hadn't even conducted that interview, and I still felt the entire time like there was something very unsettling about this particular story that I haven't encountered with our other films.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, we didn't go looking for it. It's not like that was the thing that we hoped to uncover. It just kept presenting itself. Mm-hmm. And part of that is, I think that Wisconsin, like many of the Midwest states, was settled by very religious people of a variety of denominational affiliations. But they came in and they built up large facilities and churches. That was central to their lives. And as they were establishing these areas. So it's, with the good comes the bad.
Yeah, I mean, there was, during the research phase of putting the movie together, we found all sorts of like weird activity that's taking place in Wisconsin in general. There was a massive fire that happened there that like consumed almost the entire state at one point. And this was way back, like 1800s, I want to say. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Peshtigo Fire. Okay. Yeah.
And there was, if I'm not mistaken, there was one building that survived, like at the heart of that fire, there was one building that survived, and it was a church. Mm-hmm. It was like a church that managed to somehow.
That was horrible. It was like a tornado of fire, mm-hmm. sweeping across the state. Mm-hmm.
So hell itself had come to Wisconsin.
What do you know?
I have a book.
Okay.
And when you travel through Wisconsin, there are places that memorialize it. I mean, there's places you can pull off and have the brown sign, mm-hmm. and it's telling you about the fire. I mean, it's still part of the culture.
Where do you want to go with this next?
I'd be interested in hearing Andy talk about Elkhorn itself. Yes. Having been there and set foot in the town, what do you think? I mean, we explore this somewhat in the film, of course, making the context of it, but what was it like for you to be in Elkhorn?
I think it was very interesting to be in Elkhorn because it was a place, when you think of the Beast of Bray Road, you think of Bray Road. I don't think Elkhorn is associated with it. At least to me, it wasn't as associated as the road. So to be there was a very unique experience because it's a very it's the biggest small town we've been to. I think Point Pleasant might be bigger, but it's very
Alton
built up.
I would assume Alton's bigger than both of them too. Mm-hmm. Which you haven't been to Alton, but I'm saying of the movies we've covered, mm-hmm. I think, but Elkhorn is definitely one of the bigger.
Yeah, and it's it has this very calm vibe to it, except the lady who yelled at the car.
Yeah, the lady screaming in the road.
But besides that, it was just very, it seemed like I should have been there before, in a way. Like, it was something I've experienced before. It's just...
Well, it's a quintessential small town. Like, the Victorian architecture, mm-hmm. and all that is really similar to a lot of towns here in Ohio.
Yeah.
So, you might have felt that way because it was almost like being in mm-hmm. any small town. I mean, the weird thing about Elkhorn is going into this, I was like you. Elkhorn didn't even really... We didn't even go to Elkhorn till we'd been there for 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it was not something that was... I was pushing to, let's make sure... And normally I do, but, in this case, it was all about, Bray Road. And it's weird now because I almost can't... I almost don't separate the two in my mind. Mm-hmm. They're so intertwined, especially when you got into the weirder aspects of the story, because it starts making you ask these questions about the town itself and the people there. First of all, why do you not want anything to do with the story?
Of the towns I've been to related to these types of things, it has nothing. I mean, there are some with minimal things, but there was nothing we could find. And we looked the whole time we were there. Mm-hmm. And it's, considering it's very popular and it's something that could bring attention to it, it's odd to think why they don't.
And then you bring in the satanic stuff, and they were talking about people that are involved in the town not wanting to, but at the same time, we interviewed the Brays and they're telling us that they don't think there's any commercial value to it, so maybe they might legitimately not see that value. But yeah, I agree with you. There's a weird deja vu vibe about that town that you get there and it feels like you've been there before. And it happened to me again when we were filming Terror in the Skies, because we stayed in a town called Jerseyville, and I kept commenting on how that town reminded me so much of Elkhorn, because it was way smaller than Elkhorn, but it was still this very old town, Victorian architecture everywhere, a street running right through the middle of it. It reminded me of Elkhorn. So,
and also Delavan, which is where we stayed, which has connections to the story, is very normal. It's a very one street old, reminds me of Fort Wayne, Indiana, when I think of it.
Everyone knows everyone in those areas too. I mean, the best thing about that particular place to film, I guess, is that it very distinctly sets the stage for this is the Midwest.
I'm sure.
It is as Midwest as you can get.
Yep, no doubt about it. So as far as the creature goes, what's your favorite, or what do you think is the creepiest incident that you know of? Because for me, it's kind of the newest one has really captured my attention, the 87 sighting.
There's the one, this might be more Michigan Dogman, but the one where it's the guy sees the wild pack of dogs and he fires a warning shot off. And they all run off except for one that stands up and looks at him. That's very creepy. And like, if that happened to me, that would be terrifying. And that's the most they're all very unexpected, but that's the most like goes from normal to weird real quick. The others are like weird the whole time, but this is like normal to weird.
Well, yeah. And you point out something that is kind of a connecting theme throughout most of these sightings, and that is there's a moment at which the creature looks at the person who's observing them, you know. And I think it's different than Bigfoot in a sense, because you don't always get that with Bigfoot. Bigfoot can just be walking through a field and he's not that interested in you. But it seems like with Dogman or the Beast of Bray Road, there's always this moment where you're either sure the thing knows you're there and is trying to get at you, or at least locks eyes with you.
Yeah, the stories that became you. The stories that became famous or infamous are, or infamous. Three amigos. The stories that became famous because they're very like intense encounters with something, you know, that seems to be fairly violent compared to other cryptids and monster stories and urban legends, especially like the Gibson sighting really stands out because that thing chased her car. I mean, if you're believing what she said about the incident, like that thing chased her car and clearly wanted to get at her,
yeah,
which is interesting. You definitely don't find, you know, Bigfoot sightings like that. Mm-hmm. I also, you know, I mean, that brings up an interesting point that we might not be ready to go here yet, but the most common thing I hear is that, the Dogman or the Beast of Bray Road is probably just like a misidentified Bigfoot. This comes up constantly. And if you believe Bigfoot exists, that area along Bray Road is going to be the last place you're going to see a undiscovered creature roaming about, because there's two highways right there. Mm-hmm. There's giant open fields and very little forest for anything to hide, which in itself like begs the question of if the Beast of Bray Road exists, where's that thing coming from?
Exactly.
Because those little patchy forested areas aren't going to harbor much of anything. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, that's the question, is like, where is it? That's what makes, I think, that's what lends it to a more supernatural thing so easily, is it's not like Fauk, where it was like solid woods, and you're like, something could be in there, and you not see it. But this is like, there's highways, and there's very thin woods. Like, I was always waiting for, when we were on Bray Road, to be like, oh, there's the big woods, or like, there's where it could be hiding. And there's
a wooded patch behind on the other side of that field from Lee's farm. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's private property. You know where I'm talking about? Yeah. It's like private property. And I had actually originally thought, well, maybe, you know, like I could see something hiding out in there. We were filming. We drove around, went down. And those pictures of like me, Santino, and Zach standing in the middle of the road together, those are in front of that woods, and I could see Lee's field through those forests. Mm-hmm. So like that's a very tiny patch of woods, even though it's private property. It's very, very small.
Right.
It's not even Minerva in some ways is similar. Like it's Minerva's a little more hilly, but you've got those patchy woods, but the patchy woods in Minerva connect and they go for miles. Like you could stay in forest down near Minerva and be fine. In Elkhorn, there's no cover. There's nothing.
Yeah, we had to drive about a half hour, right, to get to the southern Kettle Moraine.
Mm-hmm. It was longer than that. It was like 45 minutes or more.
And that's where you start getting into what we think of as woods. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a ways.
Yeah, yeah, and considering, you know, the epicenter, the main point is Bray Road, which is farther away than we were when we traveled to the Kettle Moraine. So it's like, it doesn't add up to be something normal.
Yeah, I mean, where do you stand? Okay, so you don't think it's some sort of undiscovered biological man-dog
beast? I sure hope it's not some biological man-dog beast. That would almost be more terrifying than being, oh, it's something from another dimension. I don't know what it is, but it's something that isn't normal. I would almost have to say that because, and meaning not of this, not biological, because all the, you know, the occult connections, the supernatural connections, all the other more supernatural stuff, paranormal stuff that happened in connection, and it happens with like most of the sightings. It's not like with Bigfoot. There's occasionally like supernatural psychic stuff, but this is like almost everything is like a weird connection. Like some,
it
some
tends sort of to thing. Come back to some sort of weird like occult type connection. You've got stories you wanted to.
I have a good story. Yeah. This is the one that I talked about before that has very recently appeared on Linda Godfrey's blog, and it is very much within the general vicinity of Bray Road. And the thing that's so interesting about it is that it predates the other big sightings, Gibson and Dreese, by a couple years. And so what that enables us to say is that a like creature, although you'll hear in some very weird ways, not exactly like what you think of as the Beast of Bray Road. And it all takes place, it centers around a man named Nick. Nick was 34 at the time of the incident. He's 65 now and living in northern Wisconsin. He lived in southern Walworth County until 1994. And this was the night of December 2nd, 1987. Nick was driving himself to the hospital with his wife in a pickup truck. He had punched a wall, long story short.
Naturally.
And so he was going north on Highway 12. He was well north of Lake Geneva. There was no other traffic around. He was going 60 miles an hour. He saw something running alongside the right-of-way fence about 400 to 500 feet ahead. And it was large, and it appeared to be running on two legs. At first, he thought it was a bear, but then the two legs thing caused some dissonance in his mind. So he sped up rapidly to try and catch up to the thing. He said he got about within 100 feet of it, and the creature stopped. It had been running, but it stopped. And so he pulled over immediately and started inching his truck forward with the bright lights on. He got to about what he estimated was 20 or 30 feet away. And at first, it was like, he said it looked like a pile of fur coats. And then all of a sudden, it started to rise. And he started to notice detail as it did. It had massive legs. It turned at the waist to look at him. He said the legs still bent at the knees. Already, it was over 6 feet tall. It never stopped sort of a leaning forward posture. It had no facial hair, although its head was covered in hair. And it wasn't really a wolf head, although he described wolf ears with a tuft like a lynx, which was sort of an interesting way to describe it, kind of crossing species. He said it had large eyeballs. He could see red veins bulging out. That's how close he was. And that the eyes were slightly glowing like it had a light bulb in its head. And Nick Gluckman, who's the guy, is really good at description. I've got a couple of verbatim quotes here, the way that he described this thing. He said it had a really short muzzle and that it had a bright pink human-type mouth outlined in red. And this is where I got. He said it had a super six-pack of abs.
Yes.
So you'd been hitting the gym.
That was me. That's identification.
Very long arms in a begging position like a dog's, like held out in front of it.
That's common.
Yep. A lot more legs and torso. He said the calves were cantaloupe size. And then here's what really got my attention. He said it looked at me with extreme hatred and malice. Its mouth opened in a sardonic sort of smile and had large, what he called shark teeth, and he could see large blasts of vapor from its nose and mouth coming out with each breath. It was making a motion with its head that made him think that it was howling, but he had the windows up because it was December and it was cold, and he wasn't about to put the windows down to hear if it was howling or not. He eased up on the brake, the truck went forward a little bit, and that caused the creature at that point to jump up and land on the other side of the 50-inch fence It was just over 4 feet tall. And his wife had been asleep during this whole thing. He yells at her at this point to wake up. She never sees the thing. But then he said that as it ran away, it ran in a sharp zigzag pattern about 125 yards to the tree line. And he said it was cartoon-like. It was like a blur, is what he said. And it was insistent that it wasn't sort of curving in a gentle line. It was a zigzag. He didn't say this, but like the Flash is what it made me think of, is that it was a blur of motion, taking these sharp right angle things. He said he thought maybe it was running defensively, assuming that he had a gun. So, you know, trying to avoid it. And then he finishes up by saying, a day doesn't go by that I don't think about this. And he said, it thought it was better than me. That's sort of the vibe that he got from the look that he had of this creature. And he said it's probably about a 30-second standoff that he had just looking at this creature. So again, this is December 2nd, 1987. This was 4 years before the original Beast of Bray Road article appeared in the paper. So it's not, you know, the kind of the reason why he felt like he should write Linda, he said he didn't hear anything about any other reports until 2007 or 2008. And he just felt like he had to tell somebody.
Well, I have to wonder, like, how many people from that area have sightings that they've never talked about, because we were out on the main road the one night shooting an Instagram live while we were, or a Facebook live while we were, Zach was doing some filming of the sign, the Bray Road sign, and that truck pulled up.
Yeah.
The guy, and I thought the guy was going to like harass us or something, but he asked if we were there filming the movie, and I responded that maybe we were. And he was like, I believe in that, or that thing's out here or something like that. And this was just like a farmer dude, like a local farmer, and he wasn't razzing us when he said it. Like, he was being like, you can usually tell if they're pulling your leg, it's pretty obvious, and this wasn't that. It was like, yeah, it's out here. So I have to wonder, like, how many people, like, even the Bray sighting, Scott Bray sighting, that he has since gone back and been like, it was nothing. But I don't know why he's saying that, because they were telling me what his sighting was. His relatives were telling me what he had seen, and it's nothing normal. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like what Linda reported is what he said he saw. There's no, I don't know if that story later got turned into a more classic, like, Dogman report where it was on its hind legs, but regardless, like, the Beast of Bray Road sightings weren't always of a quadruped. Like, it seemed to be, or of a biped. It seemed to be something that could shift from quadruped to biped pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those reports, even in our movie, are of something running on all fours. Those sightings, I also think, are very questionable, because I do think coy wolves are huge. And there's wolves, just regular wolves that are huge. And there's videos online of, like, wolves that don't look like a natural animal, that are very much are a natural animal. Like that thing that they killed in, what was it, Montana last year?
Yeah.
Or earlier this year, actually. And they've since identified it as a subspecies of wolf. Like, wolves are huge. They can be very huge, and these coy wolves are massive. So some of those reports are very interesting to me, because I have to start wondering, like, how many people on Bray Road or in the surrounding area have had their own sightings of massive, like, wolf-like creatures, and how many of them are on their hind, like, walking on two legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, okay, so if people are seeing something on their hind legs, is there a natural reason, or is there some sort of, have they cataloged, like, a wolf for any reason walking on its hind legs, even for a second? Like, I had a dog, Tin Cup, that weighed 90 pounds when I was a kid, and she would get up on her hind legs and walk around. Not long, but, mm-hmm, like, for a couple seconds. So I'm right. Curious, like,
yeah.
I'm not trying to write off descriptions as, like,
sure,
or, you know, like, eyewitness encounters as being a coy wolf walking on its, yeah, hind legs for no apparent reason. But
well, I think that's something that Linda brought up too, was she was speculating about why, you know, how could this be? And her point that I thought was well taken was in prairie lands, it would make sense for a wolf to be able to stand up and kind of look around over the prairie grasses to see what prey was out there to go after. So, I mean, said, that seems plausible.
She said the laws of adaptation or something like that. And it reminded me of these...
I can't find a video on YouTube of a wolf walking on
that must not exist then.
Werewolf caught on tape. What?
It makes me wonder, though, that adaptation thing. There's these rattlesnakes in the Wachtas that have adapted to no longer have rattles. And this is recent. This is really recent. In fact, like Daryl, who was in there with me, and he's been in there every year, he said they just started noticing it. So all of a sudden the rattlesnakes have adapted to not have rattles. Like maybe there's some sort of mechanism now in the dogs where they can stand up briefly and look around, chase cars.
Yeah, right. That one's been going around
Facebook
and stuff too.
Yeah, look up any kind of video of wolves on YouTube. I mean, they can be abnormally huge. We have to start wrapping this up. How do we want to... Yeah.
Well, one thing, too, I wanted to bring up real quick is that what you were saying reminded me of this, is that, you know, Linda Godfrey has frequently asked questions on her blog page, and one of them is, when did most sightings take place? And the peak has been August through October, when you still have some corn in the fields, but it's starting to be harvested. So that makes sense if you think of the cornfields as places that a creature can travel unnoticed, even though it's not a forest, but they can easily take that until all of that's removed, and then all of a sudden they're somewhat exposed. So that's kind of another thing to throw into the mix. But also Linda Godfrey, I think, who we keep mentioning, it's from a human element standpoint, this has completely launched her life in a different direction, to the degree that she's published, or been involved with 15 or 16 books on the subject of either Dogman, Beast of Bray Road, or just weird Wisconsin and hauntings and things like that. And it's one of those things where it found her, and she's made the most of it, I think, in a pretty winsome way. I mean, you'd never catch her out there saying, I believe this exists 100%, but she does it in a way that pulls you in. Even the skeptical reader, I think, would enjoy her writing. And it's neat. I mean, she's sort of, I always think of her as the accidental cryptozoologist, because she didn't go looking for this, but it definitely found her. And I think she's brought a lot of people into it who have kind of been on the fence if it's real or not, just by virtue of her abilities.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com, and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.